case, United States versus Taylor. Mr. Karp.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is David Karp, representing Tyrese Taylor. The first issue that I'd like to deal with regards the government's references to other bad acts, which is in two parts. First,
Mr. Karp,
yes,
if I
sir.
May, I wonder if you could raise your voice just a little bit. That thing is fine for recording, but you're competing with a GSA fan in terms of our hearing you, and it's a little bit difficult.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. The first part of this issue regards the government's reference during its opening statement to a prior 1991 offense, a possession with intent to distribute cocaine base, which was one of the charges with which Tyrese Taylor, was charged and eventually convicted. True, the judge ruled that admissible based in part on the submission of the defense. The defense included in its list of jury instructions a lesser included offense of simple possession of cocaine base. However, the government, first of all, was on notice that Mr. Taylor really had very little to gain from that submission, and it had never been submitted to the jury. In fact, Mr. Anderson was aware that the penalty for simple possession was minimum 5, maximum 20 years, so there really wasn't much to gain. Mr. Taylor was generally denying the offenses. He did not specifically say he was only going to fight the intent. He also had subpoenaed records, which the government was aware of, in order to contest or build a foundation towards contesting that he had actually left the drugs. This count involved some cocaine base that was left in the backseat of a police car that Mr. Taylor had been sitting in. So the mere fact that Mr. Taylor included this as a possible jury instruction without having said boo to the jury, I think does not justify the government's including it in its opening statement, and particularly after the decision which I know, Judge Ripple, you authored in Kiefer Jones. I think that after Kiefer Jones, that U.S. attorneys should have pause before referring to this sort of evidence in opening statement before the defendant has even said boo to the jury at this point. And, of course, we ended up withdrawing any request for the lesser included, and the judge eventually ruled that it was not, that the 1991 offense and conviction was not going to be admissible. The government faults Mr. Taylor for not alerting the government in court right off the bat before trial that it was withdrawing the instruction. But I don't see how the government stands on proper grounds thinking that it was proper to refer to this in opening statement. I would also point to Judge Easterbrook's concurrence in the Kiefer Jones case, in which he specifically says that in this kind of case where you're going to get into a prior drug offense, and particularly a conviction, that that it might be wise to wait to hear what the defendant has to say in opening statement to the jury to see if the defense is going to say to the jury something that will raise the issue. Specifically, that is specifically they're combating intent, saying they're an innocent bystander or that the defendant possessed the substance but did not intend to distribute. With regard to the other part of this issue, this would regard evidence that the government felt was inextricably intertwined with the evidence presented at trial. Specifically, I have in mind three witnesses Officer Benavides, Shane Wells, and Terry Reed. Officer Benavides points out to the jury that he knew Mr. Taylor, Tyrese Taylor, from his experience as a gang and drug officer, making it very pointed that it was in that context. Further, Officer Benavides refers to pulling over Mr. Taylor's car for wants. This is something that the prosecution had referred to in opening statement. Mr. Taylor objected. That objection was granted. Nonetheless, Officer Benavides refers to it. The government's position is this completes the story. It fills a gap. The jury had to know why Mr. Taylor was pulled over, but they knew that because Officer Benavides talked about the illegal window tint, the illegal license plate cover. Why did the government need to get into the warrants to explain the circumstances then of Mr. Taylor being pulled over, taken into custody?
So did you object or try to curtail these references?
I did object to that one, yes. Admittedly, these issues are sort of a mixed bag. Some of them are plain error. However, my position is that there's at least two errors here, and the cumulative effect is such that Mr. Taylor should get a new trial. We also have the situation with Terry Reed, Mr. Reed, who says that he called Mr. Taylor to buy drugs because the DEA agent gave him some numbers, including Mr. Taylor, and says, call these people and try to set up a deal. And Mr. Reed then makes inconsistent statements, saying at one point that he had a conversation previously with Mr. Taylor about buying drugs. It was not necessary to get into that to explain why Mr. Reed was calling Mr. Taylor. It was enough that he knew Mr. Taylor and that the agent had told him to call Mr. Taylor. With regard to the Shane Wells evidence, Mr. Wells, there was an acquittal on that count, by the way, just pointing to the fact that the evidence was not absolutely overwhelming in this case. Mr. Wells says that he had a previous conversation with Mr. Taylor. Mr. Taylor had offered to sell him drugs, and the government says this is inextricably intertwined with its case because it had to explain why Shane Wells would call Mr. Taylor, but the evidence is that Wells did not call Taylor. Mr. Wells went over to Michael Billups' house, and Michael Billups allegedly then has contact with Mr. Taylor. So Shane Wells did not call Mr. Taylor to set up the drug deal. And like I said, there's an acquittal on that count, but nonetheless, there is a prejudicial effect overall. So I would ask the court to find that the cumulative effect of these errors is such that Mr. Taylor should get a new trial. Just briefly, with regard to the sentencing argument that I've made, I recognize that there's standing authority from the circuit against me. However, I will stand in the brief and ask the court to consider that argument.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carr. Mr. McGowan?
May it please the court. Andrew McGowan for the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. And I represent the appellant, Mr. George Taylor. Mr. Taylor raised one issue, and it was based on a hope that Kimbrough would be more broadly decided than it was. Kimbrough was not that broadly decided, and it will not help him before this court. As a result, unless there are any questions.
I'm sorry, it won't help him before that? I don't understand. Did the judge discuss the issue of the 100-to-1 ratio?
The judge did not. And neither did defense counsel.
Pardon?
Neither did defense counsel. As a result, it's by plain error in front of this court.
And why is it you don't think Kimbrough helps you?
Well, Kimbrough is a factual matter. Is a case where the district court did take it into account and gave the defendant a break. I don't read Kimbrough to say that issues on plain error before courts of appeals can be sent back for...
I understand you. The judge, it had been perfectly clear when the judge sentenced your client that she was bound by the 100-to-1, right?
It's certainly
perfectly clear.
Certainly.
And then Kimbrough comes along.
Absolutely.
And we don't know what the judge would do under a Kimbrough regime, do we?
No, we do not.
And what if it turned out that she would give him a lighter sentence? Isn't that our Palladino decision?
Your Honor,
in the wake of Booker, we said that judges who had been, you know, disciplined judges had, of course, treated the guidelines as mandatory. And now the question was, would the judges, if they had known that the guidelines were not mandatory, would have given a different sentence? We said the only way to find out is to remand. Well, we had limited remand. And if the judge said, yes, if I had known that I wasn't bound by the guidelines, or in this case by the 100-to-1, I would have given a lighter sentence, or I would consider a lighter sentence. And then if that's what the judge responded to us, we remanded for resentencing. What's the difference here?
Your Honor, as you put it that way, I see no difference. Certainly under the Booker regime and the court's cases since then, there have been a little difference that the Supreme Court clarified in Kimbrough. And to the extent that the court...
We've got another fly in the ointment now, and that is the
retroactivity
of the guidelines. How do we handle that for your client? We have this rather extraordinary situation of having a guideline that is retroactive but not effective until the March 3rd, and it's the 24th of January, and you and your client are here. What do we do with you?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that. I have many clients who are on appeal, just as Mr. Taylor is, who probably would benefit from that guideline amendment.
Is there any reason why we can't just vacate the sentence and send it down and tell a judge to do something about it?
I don't see any reason. That's the only issue that we've raised, and it's certainly...
You're going to be back here one way or another. I don't know quite how, but you're going to be back here, right?
That would certainly be a remedy available to this court. And as I say, I don't know that people can, when they're on appeal, raise the same issue in the district court as it's on appeal. I just thought about that, but I don't see that.
Well, it's intervening law, right?
Yes, it certainly is.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McGowan. Mr. Anderson?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Anderson. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Western District of Wisconsin. I'm privileged to represent the United States here, and I did at the trial court as well. Let me just address, before I go on to these other things, that last issue you brought up. We're dealing with two different issues there. I mean, you've got the Kimbrough opening of one door, and then you've got the guideline reduction. They're two different things. Mr. George Taylor, if he qualifies for a reduction by filing a 3583 motion, could still get the benefit of that, and this appeal doesn't impact.
Filing a what motion?
3583. I think the motion's under 3583 that they would file to adjust their sentence for those guidelines, since that was decided to be retroactively done. And I don't know for certain whether he falls under the category that he would qualify for that. He had a minimum mandatory sentence of 5 years, and he was sentenced to 124 months, so I believe he without looking in depth into it, I think he might fall into a category where he could qualify for the adjustment under the new guideline adjustment.
Well, but what about the Kimbrough issue? Isn't that governed by our Palladino decision?
No, I think that's different as well. Now, first, Kimbrough, neither of these defendants raised this at the trial court level.
But that was true in Palladino.
But in Palladino, you see, you had all the judges were imposing sentences under the misunderstanding that they were mandatorily required.
Well, here they're imposing sentences under the belief, which we had been emphatic about in our decisions, that they could not question the 100-to-1 powder crack ratio.
And if there were any indication from a district court judge that they disagreed with that ratio.
Understood. What we said after Booker was the disciplined judges believed, as we told them, that the guidelines were mandatory. And so there was no reason for a judge to say, well, the guidelines are mandatory, but, you know, I wish they weren't. If they weren't, I'd give them a lighter sentence. There's no reason to do that. That's just, you know, dicta. Well, it's the same here. Why would a judge say, I don't agree with a 100-to-1 ratio? Because she's bound by it. So she sentences him. But it may be that once she learns from Kimbrough that she wasn't bound, she'd give us a different sentence. And that was the theory under which we adopted the Palladino procedure. And why is this any different?
If they had, well, we're dealing with plain error.
We were dealing with plain error in Palladino. We said that if a judge, under a misapprehension of law, gives an erroneous sentence, she thinks she's compelled by the guidelines or by the 100-to-1, and she's not, that's a plain error. That's an illegal sentence. So what is the difference?
You still had, even in this interim, before Kimbrough, there were district court judges who were expressing disagreement with
that
the ratio.
That was true with before Booker. They have a long history of district judges feeling excessively hogtied by the mandatory feature of the guidelines. But we said in Palladino, you don't know what sentence a judge would give under advisory once he understands that these guidelines are advisory or that the 100-to-1 is advisory. We don't know until we ask the judge.
Correct. I understand your point. If you don't see a procedural difference between Booker and...
Well, tell me what the procedural difference is.
I've already...
There is no difference.
In Booker and in Palladino, it envisioned these things going back.
Came down, why didn't you submit something?
I'm sorry?
After the Supreme Court decided Kimbrough, why didn't you tell us what the position of the Justice Department is?
It hadn't been addressed by the defendants.
Obvious. Wasn't it obvious to the Justice Department that Kimbrough was going to make a difference?
We believe only in those cases where...
How could you believe that if you knew about our Palladino decision? A decision which had been applied in innumerable cases of remands, which we said, limited remand for the judge to advise us whether he would consider a different sentence now that he understands the guidelines are advisory. And if he said yes, we then remanded for resentencing.
Right.
I'm sure we did that in the Western District of Wisconsin, along with all the other districts.
There were some that were remanded there. But there were instances where there was not a necessary remand under Palladino as well.
In Palladino, the Palladino process was applied in every case that was pending on appeal where a sentencing issue had been raised, wasn't it?
I'm sorry, say that again.
The Palladino procedure was used in every case that was on appeal after Booker, and those cases were universally remanded, weren't they?
No, there were some cases where it was determined that a remand to examine the sentences under Booker that the judge had given clear indication, for instance, if the judge had departed upward from the guidelines for some reasons, that there was a clear indication that the judge would not have
but that's not this situation.
And that's not this case?
Right.
Well, actually, in Tyrese Taylor's case, he received the minimum mandatory statutory sentence, so a remand in his instance would make absolutely no difference. His minimum mandatory statutory 20 years would be the same sentence.
But what about as to George Taylor?
As to George Taylor, it could make a difference, but again, the guideline adjustment, retroactive guideline adjustment is potentially applicable in his case.
It's a separate issue.
It is separate, but it will give him the opportunity to argue.
He's got two bites at the apple. He's got the retroactive amendment. He also has the Kimbrough decision. Unless you think the Kimbrough decision was wiped out by the action of the Sentencing Commission.
No. That's why I brought up it initially, the distinction of the filing a motion under 3583 and the Kimbrough decision, which gives the court more discretion. But if he's being resentenced under the adjustment to the guideline for crack cocaine, the parties before that sentencing can submit their positions on what an appropriate sentence would be in that context, without the necessity of necessarily vacating the judgment and remanding. Errors, the district court did not err in making its rulings denying the motion for new trial because there was it did not abuse discretion.
Yeah, but look, maybe it was harmless, but you certainly overreached in bringing in all this prior drug conduct.
I did exactly
stuff to go into.
I didn't err in engage in any misconduct in making that reference in the opening.
Intertwined baloney. You didn't have to go into that.
Oh, the witnesses' statements?
Pardon?
Are you talking about the witness? The witness's testimony.
And her testimony, including her testimony about the lick.
Sorry, I'm not following you with her testimony. I don't recall any of our female witnesses. Are you talking about the officer?
No, the woman who was with him and who testified about he said they were going to get a lick or something.
I don't think that was.
This might be
a different case.
Is that the next case? Okay, sorry.
Okay. Our witnesses here, the witnesses we had. Testified in a very limited manner, only to establish that they had a relationship with and establish a foundation for their ability and how and why they were able to call Mr.
Why did they have to discuss his prior drug dealings in order to?
The witnesses, or are you talking about the 404B? The witnesses? They didn't discuss in detail any of his prior.
Why did they have to discuss it at all?
Well, you have to put in context and give the jury. The jury just can't.
Could have been put in context without mentioning this guy's prior history.
Well, suppose you put a witness up there in a drug trial, and he's saying, "I called him on this day, and he said, I want five car parts. Can you give me five car parts?" You have, and you leave that without any context for the jury to understand what that.
Well, you ask him what does five car parts mean.
And you've got to explain. How do you know what are five car parts mean in the context of your conversation with the defendant? Why? What's the foundation for that?
That conversation. Five car parts means 5 kilograms of drugs or something. What more is necessary?
The jury.
Now, if the defendant cross examines and says, "How do you know? How do you know what five car?" Then of course everything is open, right? But suppose there's no cross-examination. Defendant's lawyer accepts this guy knows what five car parts are.
Then that still leaves open the door. You've got no foundational facts, and it was very brief, not in any type of detail.
What facts do you need? We get to the
closing arguments.
Foundational facts.
Well, you have to establish. The jury should know what the basis of the relationship between the witness and the defendant is, so that they can assess his credibility, the witness's credibility, assess the witness's ability to know what they're talking about, and to understand the context of that transaction that day. Without that, the defense can get up, even if they haven't cross-examined.
They know from the testimony that he's a drug person, dealing with another drug person. What more is needed?
It would be great if the defendant would admit that, but that's not what they do at the trial.
The witness is testifying to a conversation about drugs, and he says, and the government asks him, and what did that reference to five car parts mean? And he says, oh, that's, you know, a term for drugs. What more do you have to ask him?
You should be able to allow the jury to understand the context of the conversation and the relationship.
That's just words. What is it that the jury might... Someone testifies, I wanted to buy drugs for this guy, so I call him up, and I say, I want five car parts. And the government lawyer says, why did you say five car parts? And he says, well, when you order drugs, you don't talk about drugs. You use these, you know, euphemisms, and one of them is five car parts, meaning five X, five whatever it is, right?
So you establish...
And you stop right there. What more do you need?
Well, you establish then, by that scenario, you establish the witness's understanding what car parts mean, but the defense gets up in closing and says, you know, this guy called up and asked for car parts. My guy was probably understanding they're talking about car parts. There was no discussion about drugs at all. So the witness's ability to say, we have talked before and we have understood each other prior to this, that when we talk about car parts, we're talking about an ounce of drugs. That lays the context. It gives the jury the understanding. Otherwise, the defense gets up and says, you know, it's unrealistic that my client would sell to people who he doesn't know, he never sold to before, they never discussed drugs before. Why would a defendant just sell to anybody out of the blue like that? And makes that argument to the jury. We don't have anything in the record to get up there and refute that with, and it's too late to put more evidence in, saying, okay, this witness did deal with him before. The defendant did understand what the witness was talking about. And the jury should understand and be able to assess the credibility of that witness in that regard.
That's fine. That's a good argument.
The reference to... Now, getting back to the admission of the reference and opening statement to the 404B evidence, I went through everything that was necessary to give notice of that. We argued it before the judge. The judge made a ruling on that. I complied with the judge's ruling, and... it befuddles me to understand why Mr. Karp would get up here and say, well, the government's not supposed to take us at our word when we say we're going to proceed on a particular defense. And if I had not, you know, now I'm proceeding under the court's ruling that this is admissible evidence in my case in chief. I'm explaining to the jury in an opening statement, this is what the government's going to have to prove. Our burden is to prove the intent.
Should you anticipate defenses in your opening statement?
Not if they haven't been indicated. But Mr. Karp not only gave notice of the request for the jury instruction, but it was discussed at the final hearing before the judge. And if you look at the judge's ruling from the final hearing, her order saying that this is admissible, the government can put this in, she says it's clear from his submission of the jury instruction and the discussion at the final hearing that he intends to take this tack, that, first of all, it wasn't his drugs. But if it was his drugs... If the jury finds it was his drugs, that they weren't there with the intent to distribute them, and therefore the government's evidence of his prior possession with intent to distribute and his admission that he was going to distribute those drugs is probative on that issue of intent. And that's exactly what I proceeded on with the court's approval and that ruling. Neither one of us can read the defendant's mind. If he was going to change that, and he was there at the hearing and knew that this had been ruled admissible by the court, I don't know why he would imagine that the government wouldn't give an outline to the jury of what we were going to say, what we were going to present to them to prove the elements of the offense. If we don't open on that, if we don't explain to them what we're going to put in the in evidence, then the first they hear of this other act evidence, is when the evidence is submitted and the jury doesn't understand what purpose it's being put in there for, and they could use it for the wrong purpose.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Anderson. So, Mr. Karp, do you have anything further?
Just briefly, with regard to the reference an opening statement. I don't see after James, and particularly after the concurrence in James, that a prosecutor feels safe getting into
a prior drug offense. Didn't you invite that when you, at the hearing a week prior to trial, you took the position that the intent was still the issue, and you maintained that through the submission of simple possession instructions without drawing those before opening statement?
Judge Tinder, I had to preserve Mr. Taylor's right to eventually submit the instruction. But again, Mr. Anderson knew that I really didn't have much to gain from that. It was maybe not the best advised thing to do. I submitted a lot of things. And Mr. Anderson also brings up in his brief the fact that I subpoenaed records from the Beloit Police Department with an aim towards trying to show that it wasn't Mr. Taylor who left the drugs in the car. One of the first things the jury learns in the trial about Mr. Taylor is that he has a 1991 prior similar drug offense. And at that point, Mr. Taylor hasn't said anything. The lesser included has not been submitted to the jury. And Mr. Taylor, through me or otherwise, has never said, they were my drugs, but I didn't intend to distribute them, or I was just an innocent bystander. Just the fact that I included on the list of possible instructions a lesser-included offense simply is a very weak read for supporting this. With regard to the non-404B evidence...
Your time has expired, Mr. Kahn. I'll have to ask you to stop. Mr. McGowan? Okay, well, thank you very much. And, Mr. Karp, you were appointed, and we thank you. And we thank the defenders, Representative George Taylor. Okay,